Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from the top rope here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Isco.
And with us today is writer, former WWE writer, culture writer, sports writer, and one of the better guests on Screen Drafts.
No, there you go. Yeah. I've done this podcast a couple of times, and let's see, what other podcast is this guy
doing? Dave Schilling, how did you allow the Wesley Snipes draft to finish without Major League being on the seven?
I feel like I expected Jordan to come correct and put that movie on there, and she didn't. That's on her. It's not on me.
She said it was like her favorite Wesley Snipes movie. And then it doesn't make the list.
Drop Zone on there. I mean, not to talk about a podcast that you're not listening to right now.
Well, I love that podcast.
But you should listen to
Clay
it.
And,
it pissed me off that she did that, but it's fine.
And it pissed me off too, but at least she didn't put Monsters, Inc. in the bottom five of Pixar movies. So,
Can I just tell you, Dave, that Kenny was texting me while listening to the Pixar draft, and that the rage that was emanating from these texts, like, he was just epileptic.
Isn't that one like 7 hours long?
It's
7 hours, and it's been my only 7 hours of leisure time in the last 6 weeks, but it was worth it. Dave, thank you so much for coming to talk about Beyond the Mat and WWE 1999 and wrestling, I guess, in wrestling beyond just WWE, because it was, you know, the probably the biggest boom period for the business of all time.
Absolutely.
It was technically WWF at the time, correct?
That's true.
The changeover happened in 2002. Yeah. 2001 was the year of the WCW purchase, and it was also the last year that the WWF existed.
Yeah. And now it's, you know, now it's WWE.
Yeah, what a cool, different, fun name. World Wrestling Entertainment, which implies that wrestling is not entertaining on its own.
That's not what it implies.
World Wrestling Entertainment.
As opposed to
the non-entertaining wrestling that other companies do. It's a totally ridiculous name that makes no sense. They change it to that because of a lawsuit. That's all. That's the only reason why they changed.
World Wildlife Fund, which, of course, threw a great bash and long shot. But, Dave, so you were, I'm going to do my best to say your history, and please correct me, it's your life, not mine. You were a culture writer and a TV writer, sports writer for a long time, right?
Still, and some of those are I still do, but not most.
Right. And then you were kind of a frequent podcast guest on podcasts about wrestling, hosted the Masked Man podcast, which, you know, Dave Shoemaker was the guy who brought me back to wrestling, right?
Nice. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I didn't watch wrestling for a good like 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I thought his articles on Deadspin were fantastic. And I thought his book was really good and really started. It was the first time anyone, you know, viewed wrestling the way I viewed it, you know, as performance art, as something to be, kind of dissected beyond just what's happening in the ring and the way Phil said something to me last night when he was watching Beyond the Mat. He's like, how could something be this fake and this real at the same time? And I said, that's what I love about it. So you hosted the show with Dave Shoemaker for The Ringer. For a while.
2 years, and then, I believe. Yeah.
2 years, the height of that show. And then and then you left to write for WWE, I believe.
I did.
All right, so yeah. I
have a question right off the bat. What does that mean to write for WWE?
A fantastic question. Okay. A question that I wish I didn't have the answer to. What it means is wrestling is not just the match. You know, it's not 2 hours of people fighting. It is 2 hours of people fighting and the reasons and why they fight. Why does Stone Cold hate Mr. McMahon? Well, that's the writer's job, is to decide what's the personal issue that makes these two figures come into opposition. What are they saying? Wrestling didn't always used to be a heavily scripted art form. It used to be, you know, interviews were part of the television broadcast and they were intended just for the purposes of getting you excited about the show coming to your town. So, you know, Ric Flair would be interviewed by Tony Schiavone on WCW Saturday Night or what have you. And Flair would say, Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson and I are coming to Chattanooga, Tennessee this Saturday. And Dusty Rhodes, you better watch out. I'm the world champion and my shoes cost $7,000 and you're a piece of trash. But the important bit in there
is... That's called cutting a promo, and that was a great one.
Yeah, right off the top of my head, you can see why they hired him.
That's what he said. My shoes cost $7,000, and you're trash, which is true.
That is essentially
Dusty
what a
was
promo.
Trash, and Ric Flair was known for
Billy Bastard,
those gators having a hard time holding back.
Exactly, yeah. So... the only truly important bit inside that verbiage is come to the show on Saturday in Chattanooga, Tennessee to see the match. It is promotion. Right. And that is the fundamental premise of professional wrestling. It's not a magic trick, but it is sort of like, I guess, the tease. It's a teasing art form in the way that, you know, seduction exists in adult entertainment. It's not, you can't just go straight into the sex. You have to be intrigued by the poster on the box. You have to be intrigued by the title. You have to be intrigued by the stars. Everything in entertainment is seduction and promotion and marketing. But wrestling, it's directly in the story. You know what I mean? Like, you're writing.
I learned a lot watching this documentary, but one of the things that I didn't know is that the announcers are being fed lines by a writer, like behind the scenes.
Not by a writer.
Not a writer. Okay.
The announcers are in a headset or have a headset in their ear, or they're wearing, you know, headphones, and they are in communication with the person in the back, the producer who's sort of running the show. They're kind of like the director of the live broadcast. And for WWE, that's Vince McMahon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that Vince McMahon today?
Yeah.
Okay.
Unless he's like not doing it because he's ill or something. But
that's
that
incredible.
Would be information I wouldn't know. But when I was there, Vince McMahon would sit at what they call the gorilla position, which is a television monitor, multiple television monitors. You see it in the cameras and stuff. And he can bark at you and tell you, oh, you need to say that Shawn Michaels is a pussy or something, you know?
You have to tell Phil why it's called the gorilla position, or else he's going to think it's some like bizarre carny thing.
Professional wrestler and announcer Gorilla Monsoon sat there in the early days of the WWF under Vince McMahon.
So it became Gorilla Monsoon. Gorilla Monsoon was his name? His wrestling name?
His wrestling name was Gorilla. His real name was Gino Morella, I believe.
You wouldn't believe how not like a gorilla or a monsoon this guy was.
He was big and hairy. He was large.
He had a lot of hair on his back, shoulders,
and chest.
When we were kids, he was doing the play-by-play. He wasn't even doing the color. He would say things like, punched him right in the breadbasket. Or things like that. Or to the solar plexus. He would make up body parts that people would get hit in. But that sounded somewhat erudite.
I learned about biology from Gorilla Monsoon.
So did I.
I know that sounds so dirtier than it should.
Solar plexus is actually a real thing.
Dave, do you feel like this documentary is an accurate representation of wrestling?
Yes, it is maybe the only accurate representation of wrestling. Okay. Because it is one of the only... This and Wrestling with Shadows are the two documentaries. The yes, and that's about Bret the Hitman Hart and Bret Hart leaving WWF to go to WCW and the circumstances behind his departure. Both of those have unprecedented access to the behind the scenes. And because both of them were independently shot and produced and released without the benefit of the WWF, benefit or detriment of the WWF in their involvement, the picture of the business is far more realistic. The kind of manic energy and the Carnival Barker elements of it, and Vince McMahon's personality really comes out in those two movies, both this and Wrestling with Shadows. If for anybody who hasn't seen those two movies, watch them back to back or something.
And Phil, I would implore you to watch that as well. Wrestling with Shadows is the best documentary I've ever seen. I'm not joking. What happens in that movie, you know, the best documentaries are very often movies where the filmmakers go and expect one thing and something else happens. And Wrestling with Shadows is basically just supposed to be about Bret Hart's daily life as he figures out his next step beyond wrestling. And what happens, I really don't even want to give it away. But what happens is so harrowing and tragic and Shakespearean that you can't help but be kind of devastated at the end of it, particularly for you, a Canadian. So like Bret Hart.
Well, can I want to you said something there. The Shakespearean thing kind of triggered something for me, and I'm curious as to both of your thoughts on this. Because as I'm watching this documentary, I was really kind of hit with the paradox of wrestling to a certain degree, which is that it's inherently very theatrical, right? Like, it's deeply theatrical. And yet, it's also attempting to be unbelievably masculine. And those two things are kind of contradictory in its own way. And I'm sort of like, and forgive the pun, but I wrestled with that as I was watching this, thinking about these men that are trying to give off this intense masculinity when behind the scenes, they seem like pretty normal guys for the most part. I mean, family men and for what have you. There's just a lot of contradictions and paradoxes within this universe, which I find fascinating, but I guess, am I wrong in that assessment?
No, wrestling is an industry full of contradictions and paradoxes and strangeness. Wrestlers are deeply vulnerable people. They're incredibly insecure in the same way that actors are. But at the same time, like you said, they have to go out there and they have to constantly scream at each other and talk about how I'm going to whoop your ass and I'm the best and you're trash. But these people are constantly thinking they're not the best, because that is, I don't want to say that there's, that it's brainwashing, but in a sense it's brainwashing in the way that the promoters can build you up and tear you down. And Vince McMahon does that in this movie. Yeah. He's very seductive, especially with draws, and like, we're going to make you a big star. You're going to puke. All of that stuff, like, you're going to be the biggest, baddest son of a bitch in wrestling. Like, that's what he does. Vince. He's selling you. My Vince is what? Good?
Excellent. Excellent. You should.
That's the worst idea I've ever heard in my fuck.
When you listen to I mean, Phil, this is, you know, very, very, very inside. But when you listen to a lot of wrestling podcasts like I do, or I would say I used to, you hear a lot of people who have worked for the WWE. And one thing they all have is an excellent Vince McMahon.
Yeah.
He's gonna puke. Like I can't do it because I didn't sit in a room with him, which you did, Dave, which is insane. So yes. What is that like being in the – so, you know, Dave, you've written on TV shows, right, with other showrunners.
Yeah.
How does this compare to being in a room with any other television show you've ever worked on versus working with Vince sitting at the head of that table?
Imagine if you worked on a television show, 30 Rock, and you only saw Tina Fey for 10 minutes every week, and then she was gone. And then somebody else decided what the show was going to be about, and your episode that you wrote has been torn up and rewritten, but your name isn't even on it. Your name
nowhere.
Even if it goes well, your name's not on it.
That's nasty.
There's nothing about wrestling that is similar to a television show as it exists outside of wrestling. It is television only in the fact that it is broadcast on television. And there are cameras. But other than that, it's a totally different beast.
So I want to get into something a little bit more. I want to get into a little bit more what Phil was saying. Because how this can happen, what I've always loved about wrestling, and I'm an unabashed fan, and I you know, mention it on the podcast all the time whenever I can. I take lessons from it. I think there's a lot to be learned from watching it. The way crowd reacts, the way crowds react, and the way, you know, good and evil are kind of interchangeable and transferable, and the way to introduce characters, things like that. Okay. What I've always kind of found endearing, since the curtain has been dropped and since people started to admit that it's, you know, fake is not the right word. I think that is an insulting word, but acknowledge the existence of kayfabe, which means, you know, this is part of the show, is the vulnerability Dave speaks to, and also the carefulness with which they treat each other. Wrestling doesn't work unless the wrestlers have 100% confidence in each other.
Yes.
And what you see in this movie, which I love, is you see The Rock and Mick Foley in the back with Mick's kids, and Mick saying, "This is Daddy's friend. He's going to take care of me." And 99.9999% of the time, that has happened. And 99.9999999% of the time, that's been the intent. Right, I can rattle off the times when it's gone awry, which is like crazy when you think about, you know, how often you'd expect this to turn into what they call a shoot, to turn into something real. And that has always been very, very endearing to me.
Yeah,
the way in which these people who may hate each other in real life or may love each other in real life have generally protected each other in the context of this ring, which you don't, you know, you guys know from being in the entertainment industry, that doesn't happen. You'll be on set where your boss will throw you under the bus. You'll be on set where someone will blame someone else for a problem that's not their problem. People will talk behind some other people's backs. I believe that there's this wrestler code that I have, like, I think is almost utopian in its own weird way. So that's something I've loved about the world.
Really, I mean,
that's not what I hear say. What I mean is more, and you're right, of course, because you've been on the inside. What I mean is more this idea of, and you see it in the movie a little bit with Mike Modest. If someone throws something at the wrestlers in the ring, all the wrestlers are out to figure out who that is and how to protect the guy in the ring from the person who is intruding. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter who that wrestler is because they're a family at that moment.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily true everywhere else, but that is one of the reasons I love it, and I find that this, like, very unique world that doesn't exist anywhere else. But there are a lot of things that I love about it. What's sad about it to me is the things that you're talking about, Dave, which is it's almost like this idea that can never exist in its best possible form.
It's still show business at the end of the day. And to go back to the idea of it being contradictory, they are a family. They're like a sports team that has no opponent. You know, if the Harlem Globetrotters went from town to town, but they didn't play anybody, they just like passed the ball to each other. That's essentially what the WWE and wrestling touring companies are.
They're working together on a show.
Yeah, they're working together to put on a show. But there's also so much interpersonal conflict and jealousy and resentment that does pop up between wrestlers who feel like that person doesn't deserve the spot that they have. This person's payout is higher than mine, and it shouldn't be. I'm a woman and I'm treated like a second-class citizen because I don't draw the same money that the men do, or I don't get the opportunities that the men do. There's so much of that. It's an egotistical sport because it is about the individual and the individual becoming the star, but it is a team sport in that everybody has to work together. So it's incredibly complicated to deal with. It's a mind fuck. I don't know if I can curse. I don't remember.
No, absolutely.
It's a mind fuck.
Mind fuck's
the only word, right?
Yeah.
Because you take it a step further, and this is another thing that I've always found fascinating, but again, it's like everything wrestling, it's a double-edged sword. If Tom Cruise loses a fight in a movie, no one cares. Because he's Ethan Hunt. Right? Because he's not himself.
Sure.
If John Cena loses a fight, that reflects on John Cena, the person. If John Cena says something wrong in the ring, that reflects on John Cena, the person. Mm-hmm. So the fact that these people, who some use their own name and some don't, but they all use their own names in public, right? Mm-hmm. Like the Bella twins aren't named Bella. But they're Bella in the public sphere. Those characters have crossed over from WWE world into the real world. So the things that happen within the scope of within the sphere of WWE affect their actual lives, and that's very crazy to me. And their actual lives. And on top of that, the world at large has agreed to keep some level of kayfabe. That's crazy to me. You have people go on television who have wrestling championship belts that they win in a scripted promotion and are called champ. That's amazing in its own weird way that we've kind of allowed them to exist. Like, I think one of the most brilliant insights in the movie was when the guy compared it to the Muppets, because that's what it is. Because the world has also kind of agreed to pretend the Muppets exist too. Like Kermit the Frog and Miss Piggy will go on award shows and people will be like, yes, this is just another celebrity. Just like me and you.
Yeah, so, Baby Yoda or something.
But
at the same time, you know, we do that, but then Hulk Hogan is under oath giving testimony and he says, you know, I'm Terry and Hulk Hogan is a character, and like, you know, you can't conflate the two, but we do all the time. Like, you do conflate the two because you go out in public as Hulk Hogan. You say you're Hulk Hogan. Stone Cold Steve Austin. Nobody calls him Steve Williams anymore. Nobody calls Chris Jericho Chris Irvine. Like, they're one and the same now. And it is so, it's weird. It's very weird. And some people lose themselves in the character.
Yeah, and that's what happened. And that brings us to Jake the Snake. Mm-hmm. Right? Because nobody, and it's called, you know, I'm doing that thing that I think people involved in wrestling hate. So Dave, please take it with a grain of salt. But the thing where I'm pretending I know what I'm talking about. But working yourself into a shoot is a thing where people working is the kayfabe word. Working's, you know, you're part of character. Shooting's real. But when someone like Jake the Snake Roberts goes from a wrestler who is just, you know, the son of a guy to someone who becomes a snake obsessed minister who actually, like, you know, is constantly living this gimmick. That happened to Jake, I think, more than almost any wrestler, got lost in the game.
A little bit, but he also had demons, you know, of his own. His father his relationship with his father was not good for reasons that are addressed and not addressed in the film. You know, you come into any job with your baggage. Unfortunately, with wrestling, there is no time for you to go to therapy. Nobody's giving you the benefit of the doubt when you have a problem, when things get dark. And, you know, at that time in wrestling, and I don't think any wrestler would deny this, there was rampant drug use with everybody. You know, cocaine, pills, heavy drinking, and then, you know, performance-enhancing drugs. Not that Jake Roberts ever looked at a steroid his entire career. I mean, have you seen that man's body? I don't think he worked out. I think he just rolled off of a construction site and is like,
I love that about him. Yeah. I love to have the confidence to go out in Lycra like that and just put yourself out there. Oh,
it's with a little, it's a little tiny beer belly, and good for him. But there is no safety net. There's no time off.
Love that.
Wrestlers work 300 days a year, or they used to before the pandemic. You know, they'd be touring every day, practically. They'd constantly be on the road. There's no time for self-reflection. There's, I've got to make the next town. What's my storyline? What am I doing on TV this week? That's it. Like, you don't have time to tend to your garden, so to speak, your mental garden. You are just laser.
I was just going to say that the Jake the Snake portion of this documentary, which is without a doubt the most harrowing, and then reading that Aronofsky was obviously inspired by it to write The Wrestler. I mean, not
he
a surprise,
it, but sure, so he did.
Yeah. It's a really, really sad story. I mean, Jake the Snake is a really sad soul to watch that and see that.
He's still with us, though. I mean, he's found some level of grace and salvation. Like, it's with any addict, he's said it's still a struggle all the time, but he was able to, through that community of wrestlers, through that band of brothers and sisters, find a bit of a safe landing.
The movie says that he never sort of reconciled with his daughter. Do we know if he did post 99? Has he, or is that? I'm just curious more than anything, because they're seen together and it was really powerful.
Yeah, I think by now he has. Quote me on that, even though I am just saying that publicly on a podcast. I believe that he's talked about, you know, making amends and trying to do that kind of thing.
He's had a fairly wild last 20 years in terms of people were confident this guy was going to die.
Yeah,
like this was not a question. Him and then another wrestler named Scott Hall, E60, ESPN did a feature on Scott Hall, and they both were like essentially, you know, standing nine count. It was over.
Yeah.
And you know, as Dave was saying, there's another wrestler named Diamond Dallas Page who brought them into his house and helped them, like, nurse them back to health. And they both, I mean, I think Scott Hall's still pretty involved or around the WWE, right, Dave?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's in the Hall of Fame. I never met him, but I remember seeing him in catering at WrestleMania and being like, that's Scott Hall.
Fraser. I mean, he's my favorite guy.
That's where you see a lot of the legends is WrestleMania weekend. So and they're just kind of hanging out, eating free food.
What I wanted to ask you, Dave, was, were you a fan from like when you were like a little kid?
My fandom began probably in 1991, 1990, somewhere around there. My most vivid early wrestling memories involve Macho Man and Jake the Snake, actually. And Macho Man's wedding to Miss Elizabeth and the attack at the end of that
SummerSlam
91, the match made in heaven and the match made in hell. And Jake unleashing a cobra, I guess it was a cobra or some sort of snake onto Macho Man, him biting his arm, and the cutaways to the crowd of children weeping and people with these ashen faces. It left me shook as a child of 5 or 6 or however old I was at the time that this horrible atrocity had occurred, and will the Macho Man receive his vengeance, his pound of flesh? And that was, of course, the magic trick. That is the heat. That is the inciting incident that begins the journey towards the payoff, the big match at whatever the show might be, the Royal Rumble or something. I was like, we have to order this pay-per-view. Yeah, Survivor Series 91, we gotta order this. And then Survivor Series 91 is also the year where The Undertaker beat Hulk Hogan for the WWF Championship. 2 weeks later, there's a pay-per-view Tuesday in Texas. Mom and Dad, we gotta order that. It's cheaper this time because it's only 2 hours and it's on a Tuesday. So that's how they hook you. It's like, oh God, this horrible thing has happened to my hero, and he has to get revenge.
But at the time, there were only 4 or 5 of these.
Yes, and there were 4 a year.
It was a little more cost effective.
Yes,
to be a wrestling fan. Like then, you started to have upwards of 20.
But
right,
there was WCW at the same time. So I was also sampling WCW, which was a Southern company based out of Atlanta, owned by Ted Turner, and they would do their own 5 or 6 pay-per-views a year, plus specials on TBS that were 2-3 hours long with commercial breaks and everything. So it was still a lot of wrestling, and you still had to pick and choose. But yeah, now, or even in 2006, when there was one a month, it's just like, how do you keep up with this if you're spending $6 a month?
Can I ask a stupid question?
Keep your life over to it.
I feel like I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it anyway. The wrestlers are getting screwed when it comes to the money, right? I mean, all the money is going into the Federation, and they're getting pittance, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it used to be much worse. It used to be you get $100 a week or something, or $125 a month, something crazy, some like tiny stipend. It's like, this is what you earn, and then you'll do the shows, and then we will decide based on the gate the percentage of the payout that you as a wrestler will receive every show.
And trust us.
Yeah, trust us. Trust us that we are divvying this up in an even-handed fashion. But for the most part, you know, the big names, the Hulk Hogan's, the Macho Man's, the Jake Roberts's, Million Dollar Man, Flair, Sting, like they're making way more money. WCW, for the most part, after Jim Crockett Promotions, the company that was bought by Ted Turner, became WCW, Turner started offering guaranteed contracts to wrestlers. So you would make a salary. You would be an employee of Turner Broadcasting. The WWF, you're an independent contractor. Now they have contracts. Now they have guaranteed downside contracts where you'll make this as a minimum as an independent contractor, pay your own taxes, get your own health care, et cetera, et cetera. But you can make
more. Do they have to pay for their own travel, Dave?
Yeah, I think so. There's some, like WrestleMania, you don't have to pay for your travel. Or like the hotel. You stay in a big giant hotel. This is not a trade secret anymore because every mark in the entire world knows there's a hotel at WrestleMania where all the wrestlers stay. And we have to stay there too. That's paid for. But I think there are limits to even that.
So in 99, Dave, did you see this film in 99? I mean, you're a wrestling fan in 99. So do you remember seeing
it? Dave, where did you grow up?
Merced, California, small town north of Fresno. So WWF country. WCW was on TBS and stuff, but it was mostly WWF.
Did you have any relationship with ECW?
Not at all. Not at all. I knew of it from the wrestling trade magazines and the internet and stuff. But ECW in California, I think, was only on KPCC, KTLA or something, you know, one local channel, local station in LA at like midnight. But I grew up in
Even in New York, it was on very late on some down, you know, down dial channel until they got the national deal with.
Yeah, I wasn't trading or anything either. Like the tape trading felt dirty and weird to me as a child.
We also didn't have to. Like in first of all, it is dirty and weird. Second of all, like in the 90s, late 90s, like I don't know, I watched very little ECW, and yet I know everything that's ever happened in ECW because I just read about it.
Yeah, I read about it. Another thing that was important for ECW's penetration into my cultural sphere of influence was when they invaded Monday Night Raw. Yep. We were on Raw every week.
97, something like that. Yeah.
Did you have a favorite wrestler as a kid, Dave? Was there who was your guy?
So it changes depending on your age, right? So my wrestling fandom starts in 1990, 91. Mm-hmm. And it carries through for the, like, I think uninterrupted through the 90s. But as you grow older, the things that you think are cool about wrestlers changes. So I started out really loving the heels in WWF.
As a kid,
Flair.
Me too.
I loved Flair. I loved Piper, even though he was a babyface. He was funny and cool. I loved DiBiase. I loved Jake as a heel. But I also loved Macho Man and Hogan. Like, I didn't hate anybody. I was just like, oh, this is so cool, and I hope this character wins this match or what have you. But I
did you have any inkling as a kid that it wasn't perhaps as real as you thought? Or were you
my parents did not allow me to think it was real. My parents were like, this is fake. It is for children and it's fun. Your grandma likes it, but it's not real. My grandma's from Oklahoma and they had regional wrestling in her small town in Oklahoma. So she was like, I love wrestling. I want my grandkids to love wrestling. So that was sort of how it started, I think.
Saw this film in 99 or you?
No, I saw it in 99. To answer the question, though, my favorite wrestler at the beginning, I love the heels. Then I fell in love with Bret Hart. I just thought he was a bee's knees. He wore the pink tights and he had the sunglasses and a leather jacket. And like, all right, this guy, this is what a grown man dresses like this. And he put on the most exciting matches. Like he was the most talented wrestler of his generation. But then Shawn Michaels comes along and he's a bad, bad guy and cocky. I always love a cocky wrestler. And then finally into high school, when I've become a total shithead, my favorite wrestler is The Rock. I like The Rock more than Austin, but I really love the NWO. Like, I loved the NWO. And I became a WCW guy because the NWO storyline was so great. Hulk Hogan becoming a bad guy and Nash and Hall and all the black shirts and the spray paint. And like, oh, this is edgy. This is edgy. So I fell in love with
it. It was edgy. It really was. Like, I personally, WWE Mark from the beginning and always sampled WCW, but always kind of viewed it as, you know, the other guys.
Inferior, yeah.
Not necessarily inferior, just the other guys. Like, you know, kind of secretly thinking, like, I hope this isn't superior. You know, like, I hope that I'm not on the wrong team here. But just the other guys. Then when the NWO hit, now I think we're getting maybe a little too in the weeds, Phil, but basically, like, the NWO were more or less a bunch of ex-WWE guys. Mm-hmm. Who came over and invaded the promotion. But the beauty and the genius of it was that it really, truly felt like they took over.
It felt real.
Really, truly felt like the wheels had fallen off. Like WWE every once in a while, I'd say every 5 years, will do an invasion angle. There's one right now where someone will like kind of invade the company and kind of assert their dominance for like a couple of weeks. But it never feels like the wheels are falling off of the company. It never feels like the company's actually in danger of falling prey to the invaders taking over the company. It always feels like Vince is always going to be in charge. NWO felt for a while like this might wind up being an NWO show. Like, they did an NWO. Yeah. For pay-per-view, and they had Hulk, which was a big deal. They probably had, you know, the three hottest stars on the show, and that's unusual.
Yeah.
But that storyline ended so disappointingly. Because the sting aspect of that was like the coolest shit.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was epic storytelling. And that's what kept me into wrestling through my shithead high school years, where it's like, wrestling is not cool, man. Wrestling is not going to get you a girlfriend. Wrestling is going to hinder that. But because it became a zeitgeist moment, like a huge deal, outside of the wrestling sort of cult, I kept going. And so in 1999, Beyond the Mat was like the lifting of the veil, like the wizard behind the curtain. Like, it was crazy how much access you got. It didn't get a theatrical release in my hometown, but as soon as that thing came out on DVD or VHS or whichever, I think I watched it on DVD. I think I had a DVD player by then. I mean, I pored over it. It was the first time you really got to see Titan Towers, you know, the headquarters of WWE in Stamford, Connecticut, and to see how Vince operated and to see how the machine worked. It was, man, it was a huge deal for me.
Can I just give a brief synopsis of the movie?
Just one more question before that, I've always had kind of a difficult relationship with this movie because now I think it's an amazing film. I'm not saying it's not. And I've always thought it was an amazing film. But this was a veil that I didn't want lifted.
Interesting.
And I would say this Beyond the Mat, Wrestling with Shadows, and The Wrestler, to some extent, they're difficult movies for me because they're difficult in the way that, you know, 2 years ago, and everyone's forgotten, no one cares anymore. But 2 years ago, when all the stuff about concussions started taking over talk about the NFL, and some people were like, I'm just not going to watch anymore. I can't watch people bash their brains anymore. I can't be a party to that. I've been a party to this business that destroys people for my whole life. And I, to some extent, I was comfortable. Even I was, you know, and I was 17 at the time. I was comfortable living in, you know, ignorant bliss when it came to this business because, again, WWE, wrestling in general, provides something that no other medium provides. It's this high wire, on the fly, improvisational, you know, collaborative thing that at its best is storytelling unlike anything I've ever seen. Yeah. Like what Dave just described about NWO, you can't tell that story anywhere else. You can't tell with the Sting album. You can't tell that story. You can't tell, you know, Dave, the Daniel Bryan story at the Superdome 3 or 4 years ago, four or five years ago.
Or Austin versus McMahon you know, Hogan and Savage.
To me, Bayley versus Sasha, like if you get into that story from the beginning, like these are amazing stories that it pains me and destroys me that the people telling these stories, the company telling these stories, treat their people, and you can speak to this better than anybody, about as badly as people are treated in corporate America. So,
to play devil's, not devil's advocate, because I don't want to call them devils, but I would never do that. But to say something in defense of WWE specifically, in wrestling in general, it's gotten much better than 1999. You know, WWE has medical staff. They offer, you know, free medical attention to these people. You know, you can go to the Performance Center in Florida and get looked at. Their rehab is paid for. They have former WWE wrestlers on Legends contracts. They pay for people to go to rehab. It's not perfect, but boy, is it a far cry from what it was in 1999. And this is as good a place as any to transition into the synopsis of the movie. See that? It's professional.
Beyond the Mat is a Beyond the Mat is a documentary that focuses on the lives of professional wrestlers Terry Funk, Mick Foley, aka Mankind, and Jake Roberts, aka Jake the Snake, and Darren Drozdoff. I guess he's puke at the beginning of this, but The film tells the story of their lives as we learn the wrestling industry is not the plastic weapons, fake slap sideshow that many have perceived it as. Through interviews with the family of Mick Foley and others, we see what it's like for family members to watch as their loved ones literally put their lives on the line every week. Beyond the Mat opened on October 22nd against The Best Man, Bringing Out the Dead, Three to Tango, and Bats. It would go on to make $2 million on a $500,000 budget. It's got 82% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 83% from audiences. Ebert gave it 3 stars and said, Beyond the Mat isn't a slick documentary. Some of it feels like Blaustein's home movie about being a wrestling fan, but it has a hypnotic quality. Those who oppose boxing because of his violence acknowledge that it's at least supervised sport with rules and safeguards. Wrestling is not a sport, but a spectacle in which weary and wounded men, some obviously not in the best shape, injure one another for money. At one point, we see two wrestlers set each other on fire and then throw each other on barbed wire. There are ways to do this in which you do not get burned severely or lacerated much, but it's not simple trickery. And what goes on in the ring clearly really does hurt, sometimes a lot. After a bloody match, two wrestlers slap each other on the back and explain, the more you hurt each other, the more money you make, so the more you like each other. Like I said, I knew very little about this world. Kenny mentioned that Kenny is obviously a fan of wrestling, and he mentioned that we were going to, want to do this movie. So I went into it just completely blind and was pretty floored, quite frankly, by it. It made me pretty sad, quite honestly. Like it's seeing those guys at the top of the documentary that are trying out to be in the WWF at the time. And seeing the sort of, quite frankly, tears that I really didn't know existed, that there's a room with 200 people and that's like a big night wrestling in what almost kind of reminded me of like Fight Club in the basement when they're having their fights. It felt so desperate. And I don't say that in a pathetic way, in a desperation to be a part of this world. So such a longing to be a part of it. It's palpable. And then even seeing Kenny and I texted about this a little bit, but like the brass ring is perhaps having your own ravioli commercial.
Yeah. Yeah. There were at the time this movie came out limits on what you could accomplish as a wrestler. Because mass communication right. was what it was, and you had to be on TV to be a professional wrestler, essentially, like a working, mm-hmm. successful one. That doesn't exist anymore. And because of the internet, because of the way in which wrestling fans communicate with each other, it doesn't quite feel so ghettoized. It doesn't feel right. so dirty. I've been to independent wrestling shows where it's like, oh, there's this, we're in, the Ukrainian Cultural Center on Melrose in Los Angeles, and that's weird. But now it feels more like a cool independent rock concert. Mm. To date myself, rock and roll music, guys. Let me date myself and say that rock music is a genre. Anyway, it feels different now. And I think part of what changed it, besides just the mediums of communication improving and connecting us more, was this movie. This movie is like you're going through a filthy apartment. The first thing you have to do is lift the mattress and clean out all of the bed bugs and the cockroaches. You have to start by showing off everything that's terrible about it to then begin the mm-hmm. process of cleaning it up. And wrestling is not perfect today. It will never be perfect because it is a capitalist enterprise that has a profit motive, and nothing that has a profit motive will ever be perfect. And that's just pragmatism at play. But it is so much better than it was in this movie, because we needed to see the reality. Wrestling had always been, before this movie, akin to like the Masons. Like wrestling and Freemasonry are the two greatest secrets of the 20th century. You don't know what the hell they do behind these closed doors. Now we have a little bit more awareness of what's going on and what the trick is. And Barry Blaustein has a lot of responsibility for that because of this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So one of the things at the beginning of the film, there's this guy that we spoke of, Drozdov, who goes in to audition for Vince, right? And Vince is interested in seeing this guy because he can puke on command, essentially, right? And he says, you know, puke fits the WWF attitude. And then he does, as you guys did, the Vince impression of him saying, he's going to puke. He's going to, and he really kind of like,
there's
and
no,
really like,
even though I have heard that I've been in the same room as this man and heard him speak off of camera more than once.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
It's not because of that that I know the voice. It's because I have lived with this man in my life longer than my parents. Like, he's just there all the time speaking. I like, as an announcer, as a character, as everything. Like, it's so crazy. So
when Alex Trebek died, I tried to figure out if there's anybody I have seen or watched or listened to in my life more than Alex Trebek. Vince and the only answer might be Vince. it's crazy to think of that, but it probably is true.
Yeah.
There's something about Drozdov calling his mom after the audition and saying, you will be real proud of me, mama. I'm now known as Puke.
Well, he was joking. He was so cool. Like, that's the
No, thing. I know. I'm not saying it seriously, but even in jest, it says something.
It does say something. I mean, it says a lot. I mean, it says a lot to see, for instance, this guy Baron Corbin, who was a badass offensive lineman for the Arizona Cardinals, like a real professional football player, now have to walk around in a crown and a cape and call himself the king. And he's one of the biggest guys in the company. But yeah. What you have to do once you get into WWE is puking is an extreme example. But it is crazy the way you give your life and your persona over to this company. I keep coming back to that idea. Yep. So I want to get back to what Dave was saying about the importance of this movie. So Barry Blaustein, to his credit, was a very successful movie writer. He wrote The Nutty Professor and other things. And that level of legitimacy, I think, meant a lot in how this movie was perceived by film critics. Obviously, you know, he wasn't David Lynch, but he was legitimate enough that he had
Wrestling
to
is
make
kind of
people,
like a David Lynch movie.
I think it is. But a particular Dave, were you there for the Funhouse Firefly Funhouse with Cena?
Oh no, I was there in the genesis of that character. The beginning when it was first like, we're gonna do this thing with Bray Wyatt.
Who came like, up with that?
What the fuck is this? Yeah. But then it became a huge thing, and so I was wrong. I was totally wrong.
Did you like the Funhouse with Cena?
It was fine. It was. They did the best with not to get off on a tangent, but it was the
That's
best
okay.
they could have done. We're talking about John Cena wrestling Bray Wyatt at WrestleMania last year. And this was the COVID WrestleMania, so it took place in a warehouse. And they did like a filmed kind of vignette instead of a match. It was cool. But to go back to the point about these characters and Baron Corbin and Draws and what you see in this movie, Vince McMahon is looking for an attraction. What is going to make what about you It's going to make people want to pay money to see you. And that is why you have to give yourself up to this persona, because the persona is your, is the draw. The persona is the attraction. Hulk Hogan is just a big dude without the yellow tights and the saying your prayers and eating your vitamins. Steve Austin is just a bald guy from Texas, unless he's given the middle finger and pouring beer on himself.
Can I, there's a quote that I love that Mick Foley says. He says, "It's not like I'm going to sit at home in the future and miss being hit in the head with chairs. It's just something I do quite well."
Yeah.
And I really feel like that's kind of the essence of all of this, right? That it's just like
he sits home and misses getting hit in the head with chairs.
Yeah.
He keeps coming back.
He does.
I mean, not anymore.
Yeah, he doesn't hit the head with the chair anymore, thank God. But yeah, they miss it on some level. They miss the paycheck, and they miss the attention, the limelight, the feeling of being on the road and at the show and the creativity of it. Like, I would miss it too. Like, if there's nothing like it, you can tell. Just being in the arena, being backstage, being in that world, you can tell that there's no feeling quite like being a professional wrestler.
And you really feel that with the Terry Funk storyline.
Yeah.
You know, where there's a lot of great scenes with him, but one of the scenes that stays with me is the scene with his doctor, where his doctor's like, "You need to get knee surgery." And he's like, "Okay, but what if I didn't?" Like, it's basically what he says.
Yeah.
And the doctor's like, "Well, you shouldn't be walking right now. Like, I don't know how you're walking right now." And then later, there's a shot of Terry walking away, and he kind of stumbles or like stumbles on some rocks or something like that. And literally in my head, all I thought was, "Oh God, his knee."
It's the scariest thing I've ever seen in my life. Yeah. It's like, "Oh God, this pile of bones is going to fall apart."
And he wrestled until about 5 years ago.
It's crazy.
Into his 70s.
Yeah.
It's just there. I think the other thing this documentary did, beyond, you know, lifting the carpet and showing all the worms, was these particular guys, specifically Funk, Mick Foley, but a bunch of the other guys, but specifically those two guys, are such good people. I think what it did was humanize the wrestlers, and fans stopped viewing them as just characters. Now, I think what you'll see in the last 20 years, which has been really good for the wrestling industry, has been an enlightenment of the fan base. I think you'd be shocked by how progressive the average wrestling fan is. I'm not saying they're very progressive. I'm not saying we're talking about AOC voters. But what I'm saying is, like, you think that they are – there is a stereotype that they are, you know, the people who are raiding the Capitol, and they're not. In general, at least the wrestling fans that I think for the most part go to shows and the wrestling – certainly the ones who are going to the Ukrainian Cultural Center with Dave are people who are rooting for the best practitioners of the craft. Often people who are rooting for people who have not had their chances before, people rooting for female wrestlers, which hasn't happened, which never happened before. There's a huge women wrestling industry that was a sideshow for basically the entirety of the business. Diverse wrestlers who there's an extremely bad history of wrestling the way they've treated anybody who's not white. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's a joke that Michael P.S. Hayes, who maybe in this movie a little bit, told a black wrestler that being black was his gimmick. You know? So that has changed among the fan base. And I think a fan base has pushed the WWE in a better direction. Both with the stuff you're talking about in terms of the wellness policy. I think that was pushed from the fan base. The focus on women's wrestling, we know when that started. That was pushed from the fan base. So I think that treating these wrestlers with some respect, which is what I think Blaustein did, signaled to the audience that the game has to be different for you too now.
Yeah.
You can't just look at them like they are the Hulk and Captain America, because they go home and they have families and they're real people. I think it's been a really good thing.
I think that there's something that there's a moment in this that, first of all, Dwayne Johnson is a baby in this documentary, obviously. I mean, this is quite a while ago. He's a much smaller man. He just, you know, he hasn't become what he's become, obviously. But Dwayne Johnson calling The Rock a piece of shit was a great kind of like acknowledgement of this persona versus person that I think, to Kenny's point, I'm not sure was totally crystallized before that, but maybe I'm wrong.
It couldn't have been, because the business was designed to treat you as a rube and a fool, to be duped. It was, we're going to rile these hillbillies up and get them to come see us pretend to fight.
Right.
And we need, the heel has to make the old grannies who think it's real and the drunks who just want to scream so mad that they come back next month and pay for a ticket to see this match. Now, partially because of this movie and the way that it's framing wrestling as an art form, as a passion, as a form of expression, the fans look at it the same way. And so they cannot be duped. They cannot have the wool put over their eyes. You cannot just trot out a person from Russia with a hammer and sickle on their tights and say boo that person because they're from Russia, because we know that's they always go back to the well of xenophobia, because that's what's always worked. But it doesn't work because people are too sophisticated and too aware of the fact that that person's not actually from Russia, that guy's from Bulgaria, or that person doesn't really hate me, they're just an actor playing a part. A fabulously talented athlete who is playing a part. So you can never get that emotion that you see in this movie. The emotion of, I truly despise Dwayne The Rock Johnson. He is a piece of shit and I want him to die. In the way that, like, the real wrestling now is not wrestling. It is politics. It is Jake Paul fighting Floyd Mayweather. Where it's truly like, I find that person legitimately repulsive and repugnant, and I want to see them lose, and I want to see them suffer, and I want to see them beaten down within an inch of their life. That is what wrestling is now. Wrestling as an art form is just the same thing as comic books. It's no different than that now.
I think it's interesting because as you guys were talking, I'm thinking about Jake and him sort of losing the plot a little bit, right? Like, he kind of loses that separation, or certainly gets kind of swallowed in. He talks a little bit. There's this kind of a portion of the film where he's talking about having sex on the road, and, you know, so then it becomes, you know, one person isn't enough, then two people aren't enough, then you can't have sex with your wife. He starts talking about sort of getting sort of lost in this abyss, it feels like, of being on the road, which, I mean, doesn't sound entirely dissimilar to like musicians on the road and being in bands and stuff like that too. But there's this moment when he brings a girl onto the stage, into the ring with him. And he says she might end up being a truck driver who cross dresses or whatever, but she'll always remember that night. And I'm just like, I just don't get the guy. I find him compelling, but I'm just like, what's going on in this guy's head?
Always remember that night. He is right about that.
Yes,
every person who danced with the Junkyard Dog in the ring remembers that they were the kid that the Junkyard Dog brought into the ring. Like, these are the thing that's always kind of like been a mindfuck for me. I mean, obviously a million things about wrestling, but one thing in particular is like, for that moment, they are the center of the, they are the center of attention. They are the biggest celebrities in the room. They are playing characters that are larger than life. But for the most part, they are lower class people who don't have healthcare, who are taking drugs, who are drinking to excess, who are getting in fights. These are people who, on one hand, are able to sleep with a different woman every night, and on the other hand, are killing themselves. And so many wrestlers die young, like younger than 60, younger than 50. And so much of that is because of this dichotomy, I think, because of this bizarre juxtaposition between being, in some cases, international celebrities, and in other cases, lower class people who can, you know, who are really having a hard time making ends meet.
Yeah, when you're a working wrestler in an independent or something, it's tough. But you kind of get by knowing that there's the goal of getting to where you want to be, WWE or WCW back then or AEW now. You know, there's always the hope that you'll get to where you want to be. It's the people who come down from that mountain, like Jake Roberts in this movie, who are depressing to watch. It's depressing to right. see him know that his best days are behind him, that he physically can't do it, but he still has a desire to entertain. He still only has one talent in his career, in his life, and that is to entertain people. And there's also, again, to go back to the idea of contradictions, wrestlers both crave the approval of the audience and see them as contemptuous, you know, the mark to be duped. At least they used to. And that's not really the case anymore. Wrestlers are more amenable to the idea that the fans are what pay their bills and you need to cater to them and you can't think that they're idiots and marks and fools. But, you know, at the time this movie was coming out, it was, oh yeah, these people are dumb and we are taking advantage of them on some level, but also, God, I really need them to like me. Otherwise I'm not going to get booked again. It's so strange.
It's the same as stand-up.
Yeah, right? It is. Yep.
Stand-up comedians are the closest thing to wrestlers. Now, granted, all respect to people who can get up on stage in front of people and tell jokes. They're doing one thing at a time. Yeah. And their art form is respected. So even a failed stand-up is not quite the same as a failed wrestler. But yes, this thing in the moment where you're in front of people and you're completely vulnerable and you are essentially, you're pouring your heart out, whether it's, you know, in the form of telling these jokes that you've crafted with love, or whether you're out there and, you know, basically your underpants and trying to make people laugh, or you're trying to make people feel things for your, you know, fake fighting, and then having a situation where if things don't go well, you're gonna get heckled. Yeah. Which is a nightmare. Like, that doesn't exist. That doesn't exist for even stage actors, because if someone tries to heckle a stage actor, they'll be pulled out of there. Yep. And everybody in the room will boo and hiss that person. But, like, if you're bombing on a stage, on a stand-up, you can heckle them. That could be part of the show. And if you're even, like, not excellent at wrestling, like, people will – it doesn't happen as much, thank God. But there is a long period of time where people were chanting, "You can't wrestle at wrestlers."
Yeah.
Which is so horrible.
It's hurtful.
To do to somebody. And you're in an arena with 10,000, 15,000 people, and they're chanting, "You can't wrestle at the." I mean, you know how fucking hard it is to do.
If I was in a ring and an audience was screaming, "You can't write," I'd be like, fuck this.
Let me bring up a point we made earlier is, these are also people who, if they blow it in the ring, their scene partner could die.
Yeah.
Right. Draws is a perfect example of this. Darren Drozdov is a blue chip wrestler in this movie, but boy, at some point somebody messes up and then he's paralyzed.
So that's what happened in that situation.
So that's not something that happens often.
Right. But what happened exactly?
Was it a botched pile driver? I don't remember. It was some sort of – it was dealing with the wrestler. And there was a move, and it didn't go well, and he landed on his neck, and it paralyzed him. Like, It was a power bomb. Yeah. It's a split second, an inch or two in the wrong direction, and you're toast. Steve Austin was paralyzed very briefly in a match with Owen Hart in 1998, I think. And he almost didn't wrestle again. And that would have changed wrestling forever. And it was.
Is there another guy that also, that I don't know if he died in the ring?
Owen Hart.
Okay, yeah, that's.
He fell from the rafters. It wasn't a wrestling move that killed him, it was a malfunctioning harness. It's so dangerous, and it's unlike anything else.
You know, it's like Dave Shoemaker used to say, the best wrestler in the world is Paul Heyman. Which Paul Heyman is in this movie. Paul Heyman is the founder of ECW, Phil. Right?
Yep.
Paul Heyman is still a big deal within the world of WWE. He's basically, he's almost always the manager or the top guy. Yeah. And I'm guessing Dave has some experience with him firsthand. Yes. But because he was, did you work for him? Was he running Raw and you were there? Or?
I worked not underneath him or with him, but he was an advisor. He was a consultant to the writing staff at the time. And would eventually become the head writer again after I was gone.
So he's been in and out of WWE since WWE bought ECW, which happened right around 2001, right?
2000.
Dave Shoemaker would say he's the best wrestler. This guy didn't wrestle. But his point was everything that happens on the show, if you are on the show and you are performing, you are a wrestler. So Owen Hart falling from the rafters, it was not a wrestling move that you learned in wrestling school, but that's wrestling, right? Owen Hart descending from the rafters in costume is something that doesn't really happen in other mediums, right? That is wrestling. That is something that you ask someone who is barely trained to do something like that to do. And that
I
is
feel
a
like
bad.
Lady Gaga did it, but other than that, that's the only other person I can think of.
She did it at the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's right. Theatricality to other things, but it's not. It's a purely holistic art form because you have to do everything.
Right.
And I think that was a point that was kind of made about stand-up. Is stand-up, you're doing one thing, and wrestling, you're doing 17 things all at once, and that is impossible. You have to be a great talker. You have to be funny. You have to be serious. You have to be a great athlete. You have to be beautiful and model like, you know, you have to do all of these things. You have to be a pitch man or woman. It's crazy.
Politician, right?
Yeah, you have to be a politician. You have to be someone people want to see, an attraction. That is the crux of. Yeah.
Can I ask you who you think does it really well right now?
Oh boy, I would say Jon Moxley, who is on AEW, is the best pure wrestler in the world. Because he can make you believe. He makes it real. He makes it seem like what's happening matters to him. And that is the most valuable skill, is suspension of disbelief. And that is what made Mick Foley in wrestling such an important figure, and why his part in this movie is so crucial. It's because by committing himself to acts of unspeakable violence, he made wrestling real. For millions of people, that match, Royal Rumble 99, or what, 98, or whatever. Yeah, was it 98? 99. Yeah, Royal Rumble 99 with The Rock, the I Quit match.
Oh, that was 98. The one on the show was 98.
Okay. Made it real. Made it all so real, didn't it? It's like, oh my God, the violence in this match.
Okay. I wanted to run with that for a second, because that's how the film ends with the I Quit match that you're talking about. Correct?
It is Royal Rumble 99.
Right.
It's 99?
Yep.
Oh, sorry.
Royal Rumble 1999, January 24th, 1999.
What I found so powerful about this, and what taps into what you're both talking about in terms of juggling all of these different things, is that Mick doesn't perhaps realize what he's subjecting his children and wife to, you know, when they're about to watch him fight The Rock. Now, I think he has an inkling, and he tries to sort of preface it with the kids by saying, he's my friend, like, don't worry, it's okay. But when he watches the footage at the end of the film and sees his children crying, sees his wife essentially screaming, saying, stop, it obviously really breaks through to him, and he understands that obviously he never wants his family to watch him wrestle again, but it really just goes to show how powerful a medium it actually is. Like, we are watching these people, even if it's a performance, they're still performing as though they're violently hurting each other. It's still very powerful.
You have to do it that way. And that's kind of the point I was trying to make, is the reality of this moment, this match, the I Quit match, and the number of chair shots that he takes, and the actual pain that really is on his face, is what made Mick Foley an attraction. It's what made him a superstar, is because the violence that he subjected himself to was real. It was so real that you can't fake a chair shot. And even though these children witnessed this match, even though they saw their father bludgeoned within an inch of his life by The Rock. They all still work in the wrestling business. Mm-hmm. Dewey Foley worked as a writer at WWE.
Yeah. And she was, and the daughter was trying to be a wrestler up until last year.
Noelle, you know, and Mick, they were on that reality show on the network. Noelle's boyfriend is a wrestler. It is just in your blood. And
Mick, you know, the reason I thought it was 99 was because I was mistaking it with the Triple H Mick Foley match the
that
year
was
later.
2000. Yep.
That was a 2000 Rumble, right.
Yeah, and it was a similar sort of brutal match, but not as brutal because they couldn't do it again. It was a street fight at Royal Rumble 2000.
I remember it clearly because that was the first time they brought out the barbed wire bat in WWE. Yep. This is a bat covered in barbed wire.
Believe it or not, they tried to do this again after this movie came out. This movie comes out in October 1999. It comes out on DVD and VHS in 2000. You would think, like, okay, let's pump the brakes. This is too much. People are starting to see that this sport's really fucked up. But then they're like, let's do it again because we know Mick Foley is going to do what we need him to do, which he did the year before. And what is that? That is get heat on the bad guy. Mick Foley is the most sympathetic character in wrestling at this time. If you see him get his ass whooped, you know it's real. You know he's suffering, and you know you love him. And so when The Rock beats the shit out of Mick Foley at Royal Rumble 1999, what do you want to do? I want to see Stone Cold Steve Austin get revenge for Mick Foley at WrestleMania, and I'm going to pay $59.99 to see that motherfucker get his ass kicked. And then the next year, Triple H beat the shit out of Mick Foley at Royal Rumble 2000. And you know what? I hope that The Rock beats Triple H again for WrestleMania. And I'm going to pay $59.99 to see that happen. That's why Mick Foley is a superstar. That's why he's a millionaire, is because he made people believe and he made people want to see somebody get revenge on his behalf.
Can I also say, he seems like a really nice guy.
Yeah, he is.
He just, I didn't mean to say seems. I mean, obviously, just don't know him. But like, all of the footage of him with his family, I mean, I don't think that we really needed the flashbacks in slow-mo with Stand By Me playing. But all that being said, I think that you really, I mean, he's a great dad. He looks like he cares about his family tremendously. And I don't mean to suggest that he wouldn't have these attributes, but he just seems like a really good human on top of all of it. So of course you want to see someone get revenge on
nobody dislikes Mick Foley.
Wrestling at this time was very lucky to have Mick Foley. Not just for the reasons Dave was talking about in terms of storyline and his utility that way. But Mick Foley was able to legitimize wrestlers in a way that no one else had before. Hulk Hogan would go on The Tonight Show or whatever, Saturday Night Live. He would still wear the stupid shirt and still pull it apart and play the part of a, you know, dumb jock from Venice, California. Mick Foley's move after the Ravioli commercial was to write an autobiography, not ghostwrite an autobiography, which everyone was very clear that he wasn't being ghostwritten, because there were others that were ghostwritten, and it was, you know, it was
the whole industry at WWF had of like, we'll find a writer to write the book with the wrestler, and it's a brand extension opportunity. But that wouldn't have happened without Mick Foley saying, "I'm going to do it for real." You're 100%
right. He did it for real, and he also was able to continue to do what he just did with you, Phil. He would go on TV over and over, and he never changed his look. It wasn't like he cleaned himself up. But he went on TV over and over again, and he was smart and articulate, and he was vulnerable, and he was thoughtful. And I think he went a long way towards changing the perception of what a wrestler could be. I think The Rock built on that to some extent. I think Stone Cold built on that to some extent. But I think Foley, more than anybody, opened people's eyes to even the guy who was taking chair shots, taking the barbed wire to the face, having the tooth fall out of his nose, which isn't really what happened, but have tooth fall go through his lip, which is what happened, has a brain and has a mind. And for me, like, when I hear wrestlers talk about wrestling,
I almost never hear a glorification of violence. I almost always hear the kind of things Dave's talking about. How do we get people excited? How do we get people to come to the next show? How do we tell a story that's going to keep people, you know, on our channel and that kind of stuff? And how do I work with these people? And how do I, you know, wouldn't it be fun to work with this person? There's someone, I mean, again, these are all secondhand stories because I only read about it on the internet, but Dave, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but Carmella, the wrestler, I think has done a really good job of keeping herself relevant by finding unusual people to work with, right? Mm-hmm. I think she pitched herself to work with James Ellsworth, who was this like kind of weeny guy, but there was something about him that people tuned in for, right? She's this very attractive wrestler who kind of didn't have anything.
Guy, and it'll be funny. Yeah.
Well, that's what Vince loved, right?
Yeah, it's but he just contradiction. And it's interesting pairings. It is about the attraction. It is about why am I going to watch the show? The violence is the tool to get people to pay attention, and violence has to be used judiciously. And that is the question in this movie, with the number of chair shots in the I Quit match, and you know how violent does it need to be? And Foley is always going to say it needs to be more violent. The Rock is going to say it needs to be more violent. Vince is going to say it needs to be more violent because this is the moment that they sell you on, I got to see The Rock get his ass kicked. So it has to be brutal enough to shake you out of your complacency. Wrestling can't go that place anymore because of this movie. Wrestling can never go to the point where it's so shocking that it makes you viscerally upset because you can't do it anymore. They don't even do a blood that often. So wrestling is never going to reach the heights that it did at that time because it cannot shake you out of your complacency. It cannot make you forget that it is fake the way that Mick Foley did or The Rock did here in this movie or the way Jake Roberts did when he literally had a snake bite Macho Man Randy Savage. The reality is not there, but the reality is still there for the wrestler. In this movie, you see these people and they still believe it's real because they have to believe it's real in order to be effective salespeople.
So, Dave, as someone who went to the inside, what, 4 or 5 years ago?
No, it was 2019.
So I assume you went there with thoughts on how to modernize the business or what you wanted to bring to it. So what would you do? Because given the reality, you're just pointing out that it could never be what it was. What would you do differently if you were handed if you were handed the reins, if Tony Khan called you and said, we want to bring you in and run AEW, which is this
instead of me getting to do it myself, I want you to do it. Yeah, that will never happen. But if it did, I would say, one, they're doing a great job on AEW already. Two, WWE is the problem, and the WWE is so heavily scripted and formatted. It cannot deviate from the format the way that it does in this movie. In this movie, you see that they're always trying to surprise people. They're always trying to do things where you're going to be shocked. You're going to be taken out of your seat and shaken, like I said. They can't do that anymore because it's too hard. It's difficult. That's an easy job. And the head of the company, the person, the head writer of WWE is in his late 70s. So, like, it's never going to be fearless. It's never going to be dangerous. It is a corporate product. And so without that sense of the unpredictable, it will never connect with people the way that it did in 1999 when this film came out. It just can't. It's not possible within the framework of WWE.
So
can I ask a Vince question?
Sure.
Vince is still running WWE. Am I correct in that assessment?
Certainly, or no? Yeah.
Is he still wrestling?
Oh, no. No, he's – I mean, I'm sure he would under the right circumstance, but I don't think it would – I can't imagine it would be wise at his age.
Because when he shows up in the documentary in the ring, I was just like – that was a real mind-blowing moment in the documentary for me where I was like, what now?
Oh, yeah. Think about wrestles in that in Royal Rumble in that year.
Think about what that was like for every kid who grew up watching this guy – as the play-by-play guy in a suit and not even what anyone really liked. Like, not even a special one, right? And then around 96, 97, they acknowledged he was the owner of the company on camera. But still, like, he was a weenie. Like, this is Vince. He was a weenie.
Which is funny because he's a giant of a man. He's huge.
I had no idea that he had that body under there. And the weirdest part about it was his main foil, Steve Austin. As a, you know, he's a very in shape guy. Yeah. But he doesn't look like that.
Yeah, Vince is and like jacked. There's insane. A gym. There is a weightlifting gym in Titan Towers. And, you know, you're encouraged to use it. And Vince uses it. And Vince works out more than some of the wrestlers. Like, he is very serious about his fitness regimen and looking the best he can. He lives his gimmick too. Like, he really does. Like, he's a serious person. And yeah, he's very much in charge of WWE, and he will be for a long time. But I would say it doesn't really come across as much in this movie because you see the real man. But the Vince McMahon character is the greatest bad guy in wrestling, maybe one of the greatest villains in American popular fiction that's ever lived. Like, or ever been created. Like, Mr. McMahon, that's the character, is so evil, and he was so good at playing that character, and you would believe that he was willing to sacrifice his daughter to a devil worshiper, or that he would like double cross Steve Austin and risk his own company just to see this man brought low. Like, he just, it's so good. Like, him and Austin together is so incredible. Nobody made him angry like Vince McMahon.
So the thing that happened in wrestling, and you talked about this a little before, Dave, was when wrestling fans started to appreciate the heels and started to appreciate how good they were at pissing off the audience in a way that wasn't booing, in a way that was cheering, right? So then you had this period where all these bad guys were getting the biggest reactions, making it so hard for a new bad guy to emerge. But Vince, for the most part, was able to maintain his extremely negative reactions for a very long time. And in today's environment, where everyone is wise to what's actually going on, that's incredible. Like, yeah, he was so good at this.
Well, because he's not cool. There's nothing cool about that character. He is
no.
Serious and talks like this and patronizing and ladies and gentlemen, you will not get what you want to see tonight because I won't allow it. Like, just very good at it. And it doesn't come across here, but he knows wrestling better than anybody. The mechanics of it, the psychology of it. It is a psychological game that you are playing with the audience. And there's hardly anybody on this planet, maybe Ric Flair, maybe Austin, maybe The Undertaker, who Shawn Michaels certainly, who know that art form as well as he does. Mick Foley's probably another one of them.
So the very end of this film, there's a mention of Droz's injury, I guess is the best. Perhaps the best.
Yeah,
Droz's injury.
Mm-hmm.
It's very quick. It's barely on the screen. I think I counted, and I don't think it's on the screen for 7 seconds. I guess my question is, I mean, they obviously had to put that in there because it happened, right? And it happened, I guess, a couple months before the release of the film. I don't know that it necessarily leaves the film with the message that was intended, but I guess I wonder what you guys think of that.
I mean, I think the message of the movie is not an obvious message. And that's part of what I like about the movie is it doesn't tell you wrestling is good, wrestling is bad, wrestling is good for people, wrestling is bad for people. It shows a lot of the warts of wrestling, but it also, I think, shows you what's beautiful about it and what is appealing about it. And I think no popular art about wrestling has ever captured the duality of it the way that this has. Even Wrestling with Shadows, which is a good movie and is compelling because of the real story of Bret Hart being manipulated by Vince McMahon. Even with that, it's not as good as this because it does get to the heart of the strangeness of it and the beauty and the ugliness of it. Nobody's ever captured that. No. Glow is a show that is ostensibly about wrestling, but it is not about wrestling at all. It is about other things. The Wrestler is about one very small part of wrestling, but it is does not capture everything else about wrestling. This gets to everything that you want to know about it. Everything from the backstage of the biggest company in the world to the ticket takers at the smallest wrestling show, Paul Heyman's speech that he gives in this movie, you know, all of those things that encompass what wrestling is are in this. And this is the only one that has ever done that.
Do you think it's... So there's a show coming out on Starz called Heels.
Yeah.
Do you think it's... And one more thing. It does seem like at least they have a basic understanding of all the things you're talking about. Their perspective on the business seems to mirror what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's possible for a scripted show or a scripted movie to tell the story of wrestling in a way that's as, obviously you can't get it as comprehensive, but as compelling and as realistic as this movie?
Yes, that's all I'll say. I can't.
I feel like Dave might be in development on something like that.
I literally cannot say more than yes.
That's awesome. That yes is a great answer.
So do you want to rate this, Kenny? Does that feel right to you? Or is there are there other things you want to tap into? Or
I could talk about wrestling all day long, but I just want to know who's cool. I don't need to know who's not, but who's cool. Who did you like? Who did you like working with? Who did you like writing for? Best.
That's my favorite Kenny question ever. Who's cool?
Who's cool? Who did you like working with and who did you like writing for?
You're not writing for anybody unless you're on the road. And for the most part, I was in Stanford writing from the office. So I can't say like, oh, I love writing for that person or not. But, you know, people that I interacted with that I thought were great. All the New Day guys are awesome. Baron Corbin is a really down to earth, cool guy. Jeff Jarrett was in the writer's room and he's a pretty smart dude. Road Dog knows wrestling really well. Paul Heyman is a wealth of information. You know, lots of people are really good at their job and really cool and really smart. The writer, all of the writers from the top down, you know, are trying so hard and it is an impossible job. Every single person who writes at WWE deserves a medal.
Yeah.
It's hard. And they don't get any respect. And they deserve respect.
Let's rate it. That was good.
Dave, on this podcast, every week we rate the film that we're talking about. If we saw it at 99, we give it a rating of 0 to 99, 99 being the highest, 0 being the lowest. And then we rate it again now if we saw it recently. Now, I know that Kenny and I just watched it. I'm not sure if you watched it again. I'm assuming you probably didn't. You know it pretty well, it seems. But I'll go first. I had not seen this film before. I watched it yesterday and was pretty floored by it, quite frankly. I think I probably give it an 82, 83. I'm in the sort of the low 80s on it. I honestly... didn't really know what I was about to sit down in. I didn't really know what to expect from it. And if I'm being completely frank, didn't really know how I felt about wrestling before I sat down to watch this thing. And it was a really powerful human experience about people that, that are, I mean, honestly, it felt like people searching for love in an industry that just, seems kind of loveless. It was really powerful. So, I'd probably give it I'd say around 82, 83 is where I'm at. But Kenny, what about you?
I did see this in 99 at the time. As I said, conflicting feelings. It's hard as a wrestling fan to see Mick Foley's family, watch him get beat in the head and go and watch it again the next day, which I definitely did. I own this DVD. I watched it more than once. It was also really validating to have this taken seriously and given this kind of treatment. Because for my whole life, the closest thing you ever got to wrestling in mainstream was Hulk Hogan doing No Holds Barred or something like that. So it was kind of a new moment in that. So in 99, I would give this probably an 80. Watching it before the podcast, I mean, it went up. I think this is, above all, everything we said, I think it's an incredibly watchable podcast. I think it's a very fast podcast. I think it's a really well-structured documentary with three incredibly compelling characters at its core. There are things that, like, for the Terry Funk stuff, we didn't even talk about, his decency with the wrestler who hadn't worked in 6 years, giving him the managerial job, the refereeing job. There's a basic decency to these guys that's lovely and kind of incredible. So watching it before this podcast, I'd give it a 90. And after the podcast, after, you know, I feel like, Dave, you kind of rode for it in a way I didn't necessarily expect you to. And using the, you know, kind of using the term beauty when it came to it made me feel better about the whole thing. It's more than just an important expose. It is an important document of wrestling at that time and understanding this, like, you know, uniquely American art form at its apex.
So
I'm going to give it a 92.
I think wrestling is the most American art form that there is.
So do I.
By far. It encapsulates everything about America. The grandiosity, the hucksterism, the can-do spirit, the multiple levels of reality. It's America to a T. And you can see how American wrestling is by the fact that the president of the United States, until a couple days from the recording of this podcast, is in the WWE Hall of Fame. And everything that he did, everything about his political style comes from wrestling. He is the ultimate heel. The only bigger heel than Vince McMahon is Donald Trump. And he took his heel heat and his ability to rile up an audience and to get attention and rode it to the White House. So this movie is incredibly important. Everyone should watch this movie and understand the psychology of professional wrestling and the psychology of manipulation and the psychology of emotional manipulation. Wrestling is not an insidious art form, but it is an art form that can be used in an insidious fashion. And to humanize the people that do it, to demystify the ways in which it manipulates, and to hopefully find some grace for the people who are practitioners of this art form is crucial to us understanding and hopefully healing the world after what we've been through the last 5 years. So I hope everybody watches this movie if they haven't watched it already. And I this is, to me, a 90, 95. Because of the resonance it still has, because that people don't make documentaries like this anymore, where they really are verite sort of slices of real life versus let's have a bunch of reenactments and animated sequences and let's spice this up. This is boring. There's
nothing cute about this movie. Yeah.
Vince McMahon would never make a documentary like this because it would
never
need graphics and explosions and music.
Until this moment, and Dave, I don't know if you have to go, but you opened the door that I want to walk through. The Trump element that I've always been kind of thrown by, everything Trump, but there has been a through line in the media in talking about Trump that Trump is a professional wrestler. That assumes, to me at least, that he knows what he's doing. There's an possibly apocryphal story about a time when Vince McMahon, on camera, was in a limo that blew up. And Donald Trump called to see if Vince was really dead. That's who I think Donald Trump is. Donald Trump is someone who looked at what Vince did on camera and thought, that's a man. That's a leader. That's a boss. And I don't know if Vince is like that in real life, but he can't be like the Mr. McMahon character. No one's like that except Donald Trump. But the fact that Donald Trump took the Mr. McMahon character, stole his catchphrase, the catchphrase, the apprentice was, you're fired, was something that Vince had been using for years as something a bad guy does, like as something an asshole does. And Trump used it as something a fucking hero does. So what happened there with Trump, with him taking Vince and in his mind, in the mind of a lot of people in America, 75 million people, turning him face, which is to say making him a hero, is something I don't think – Dave, you made the point so much more succinctly than I can. But wrestling and this movie and understanding wrestling and understanding this movie goes a long way to understanding Trump, but we're not even there yet because I now need the documentary of the Trump presidency where I understand how much of this is a shoot and how much of this is a work. And I think it's all shoot.
Yeah, well, I think – and not to go off on a tangent at the end of a podcast that is a tangent that is very heavy, but just to succinctly put a bow on this topic, I think Donald Trump learned a lot from his experience in WWE at WrestleMania 23. I think he developed, because if you watch that show, those shows, he doesn't have the stage presence. He doesn't have the sort of charisma. He doesn't have the things that you expect Donald Trump to have. He's just a guy who seems very uncomfortable with the idea of being in front of a live audience. But I think he got the taste. I think he got the taste for it. I think he got a little taste of like the most potent drug imaginable. And he couldn't let go of it. And I think he saw the potential in riling up an audience like this. But he doesn't know how to wield the dark art. It's you know, he didn't know that for a wrestling character, for a heel, the psychology is you want to see them get their ass kicked at the end, which is what I said before about Mick Foley and about Triple H and The Rock, and The Rock in this movie is like they're building up The Rock to get his ass kicked at the end. And what Donald Trump didn't understand is every wrestling story has a payoff and the bad guy loses. And the payoff,
well, he lost.
It's the capital. That was the blow off and he lost.
This has been a tremendous episode, David. I can't thank you enough for being here. But I also just have to say, the way you wrapped up this documentary within America and all of that, I mean, I truly couldn't have. First of all, I didn't see the parallels until you said it, and then it gives me that much more respect for this documentary, which is already an incredible piece of.
Oh, not hi, just 86 so low.
All right, I mean 87.
Never in the history of wrestling will there be another movie like this, because they'll never allow it.
And I don't mean to put wrestling aside, but almost putting wrestling aside and just talking about what you're talking about the socioeconomic commentary of this documentary, you know, what these people are striving for, what they're longing for, and how that is baked into the American dream in so many ways. I mean, it's an already powerful documentary that you just took to another level for me. So I really do appreciate that.
Sure.
I don't want to speak for Kenny. Kenny's going to speak for himself. But this was a thrill to have you on here and to shine a light on a world I knew very little about. Was just a real
thrill. You're the guy I would have picked out of all the guys. So I feel very fortunate that we have a mutual connection through Clay. And we were able to get to you. So thank you so much.
No problem. Yeah, this was great. And I will always love talking about wrestling, even if my experience making wrestling was not ideal. I still love it despite everything else.
Phil, what are that we doing next?
I just want to say one quick thing. That feels like wrestling in a nutshell right there. This idea of like, even if I still love it. It's like, I just think that's next week. I did an episode with Tori Brevetti and Emma Frazier on the Rolling Stone covers of 1999. We walked through each cover and the various things that were in each issue of that magazine over the course of 1999. And it was a total blast. They were a lot of fun. It's a great episode. I don't know if it's as good as this episode, though. I'll be perfectly frank. This was a tremendous episode of our podcast. And again, Dave, we really can't thank you enough for being here.
Thank you for having me.
One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episode, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.